We've come a long way from the logging methods of yesterday. Even the saws are mechanized. But there's still a thrill when the faller cries.
Listen to that crackly sound. It must mean Felix Bonnell is here. That's from an old Weyerhaeuser promo film. And that company and that family have been prominent in the Northwest for well over a century. And now, a long-ago kidnapping from a member of the Weyerhaeuser family has inspired a new book, which our resident historian Felix Bonnell is here to tell us all about. Felix is brought to you by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning.
Morning, Colleen. Yeah, this is probably in the top 10 of most notorious crimes in the Northwest. It was back in 1935 when little 9-year-old George Weyerhaeuser, whose great-grandfather founded the company, was snatched by kidnappers on his way home from school in Tacoma one May afternoon. Now, this was not long after the infamous Lindbergh baby kidnapping in New Jersey. It was in the middle of an era of high-profile bank robbers and other criminals, along with the rise of the FBI, which J. Edgar Hoover was in the process of founding in 1935 from the predecessor agency he'd taken over a decade earlier. Now, the fact the Weyerhaeuser kidnapping happened here, it's not a secret. It comes up in magazine articles, and it's there in any Northwest history timeline. But a local author named Brian Johnston has the first ever full-length book about it coming out next week. It's called Deep in the Woods, and he went really deep into the FBI documents and court transcripts and even managed to snag an interview with someone very close to the case. Now, I spoke with Brian Johnston a few days ago. He says when it comes to the characters involved and to the narrative of what happened, the research he undertook did not disappoint.
The thing plays out like a Hollywood movie. I mean, half the stuff in here I couldn't make up if I tried. You know, when I was researching this book, I would constantly be running upstairs to my wife saying, "You cannot believe what I just learned about the story." It was just golden nugget after golden nugget. It was remarkable.
That's like Seattle's morning news, golden nugget after golden nugget. First of all,
exactly.
George's great-grandfather is Frederick Weyerhaeuser. He's the guy who started the Weyerhaeuser dynasty. Brian Johnston says he'd still be considered the 12th richest man in American history. For comparison, another local guy, Bill Gates, is number 11. So little George Weyerhaeuser was a natural target for a kidnap and ransom scheme. And so around noon on May 25th, 1935, he left the Lowell School on foot, and he wasn't there to meet his sister outside the Annie Wright School for their chauffeured ride home. When he still wasn't home by early afternoon, his parents, John and Helen Weyerhaeuser, called the police. Around 6:30 p.m., a special delivery letter containing a ransom note arrived at the Weyerhaeuser home. This is from an old newsreel.
This ransom letter was turned over to the FBI. 9-year-old George Weyerhaeuser kidnapped. They made him sign the back of the envelope as identification to his parents. The G-men made a searching study of this elaborate kidnap message. He gave a list of the size of the bills to be paid in the ransom money. $200,000.
Side note, should we be reading the news like that again with dramatic music and emphasis like that?
I really think we should end the sound of a projector, like projector sound effect in the background so it sounds like we're delivering a newsreel script. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they asked for $200,000. That's pretty audacious for a couple of reasons. Number one, that's equal to about $4 million today. It's four times what the Lindbergh ransom was, and it's the same dollar amount as what hijacker D.B. Cooper would ask for 36 years later. So it's way off the charts. So even though George's dad is John Philip Weyerhaeuser Jr., he doesn't have that kind of cash just lying around, and it takes him a few days to pull it all together. Meanwhile, the kidnappers have placed George Weyerhaeuser in a hole in the ground near Issaquah. Then they take him all the way over to Spokane, driving on historic Route 10, I might add, and they stash him in a rental house on South Hill. Now, I checked a week ago, and I looked at it. The house is still standing, relatively unchanged. So the Weyerhaeusers get the money together. George's uncle follows a bizarre series of instructions, like a scavenger hunt in reverse, to hand it over to two men on a dark stretch of road midway between Seattle and Tacoma. So once the kidnappers have the money, they drive back to Spokane to get George.
They load George up in a box, put him in the trunk of their car, head back across the state, and they have no idea where they're going to drop George off because they hadn't planned that far in advance. These guys were not the sharpest tools in the shed. So they finally decide to leave George on a timber road out in the forest of Issaquah, again, really close to where they had him buried in the ground. And so they dropped him off in midnight. And they said, "Here's a dollar and a blanket." And they said, "Your dad's going to come pick you up." And they just left.
So little George is standing out there in the dark in the woods. It's not freezing, but it's not exactly pleasant. He doesn't know it at that point, but his parents and the police, none of the good guys, have any idea where he is.
And he finally says, "This is stupid, I'm leaving." So he starts walking. And he walks for miles. And he finally gets to this farmer's house. And he knocks on the door, and the farmer answers the door. And he goes, "Hi, I'm George Weyerhaeuser. Can you take me to my parents' house? So out of nowhere, this farmer answers the door, and standing on his porch is the boy who's been on the front page for the last week, just magically appears out of the blue.
So the farmer, a poultry guy named Boniface, drives little George home to Tacoma to reunite with his frantic parents. That's when the federal boys, who've been lying low before the ransom is paid, kick into gear. The investigation and the manhunt, well, part of it anyway, goes remarkably fast. This is some more newsreel audio.
The FBI has a nationwide system of hunting down kidnapped cash. The G-men made up a list of their own. Washington Press ground out hundreds of thousands of these. They circularized the nation, banks, stores, and filling stations, any place where money might be spent. And the trail led to Salt Lake City, where in this 5 and 10, one of the bills on the list was changed to buy this cigarette case. And swiftly, an airplane was taking Harmon Whaley and his wife to Tacoma for trial. He gets 45 years. She gets 20 years.
Yeah, so there were a total of three kidnappers. All were eventually tracked down through the serial numbers on the ransom money, again, which the FBI was still using that method after D.B. Cooper 35 years later. So two were a married couple, 24-year-old Harmon Whaley and 19-year-old Margaret Whaley. They were arrested in Salt Lake City. That was about a week after the kidnapping. A third guy took a little bit longer. He was a 32-year-old career criminal named William Mahan. He and Whaley had met in prison in Idaho and figured George Weyerhaeuser would be a good target because one of his grandfathers had just died. They figured mom and dad would have extra money from an inheritance. He was captured in May of 1936. Now, I mentioned Brian Johnson had tracked down someone very close to the case. That person is George Weyerhaeuser, little George himself, who's not so little anymore, and who was 94 years old when Brian interviewed him a few years ago, and who's now 96. This is just a snippet of Brian's interview. The audio quality isn't that great, but we get a sense of how George Weyerhaeuser looks back on this incident from his childhood 86 years ago.
That was considered a heinous crime, you know, and it still is. I consider it to be a novelty and a dangerous occupation involved in, but, you know, it had a wrap-up that was all's well that ends well. I always felt that of all the people in the world, that my mom and dad, I feel still very badly what happened to them.
Yeah, and there's many, many more twists and turns of this book than we could fit into a radio story. It'll make your head spin. The book is called Deep in the Woods. Author is Brian Johnson. It's available for pre-order now, and we have links at My Northwest.
Oh, sounds like a great book. I need a new one. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Colleen.
Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. Rapid fire changes as the region reacts to dire data regarding the Delta variant and the new Mu variant already making its rounds across the U.S. Let's talk numbers first. New data released by the American Academy of Pediatrics show the Delta variant is affecting children significantly more than earlier iterations of the coronavirus. According to the report, children made up almost 30% of all cases last week. That has both Pierce and Snohomish counties hitting all-time highs, too. In Pierce County, the 14-day case rate per 100,000 people is 641. The hospitalization rate is 21 people per 100,000. Snohomish County also hitting all-time highs for case counts, and hospitals are overwhelmed with COVID patients, too.
There are 107 COVID inpatients in acute care facilities, 30 on ventilators. People in the ICU has gone up about 40 or 50% over the last week or so.
30 people on machines that are breathing for them. Health Officer Dr. Chris Spitter says ICUs are running 80 to 90% capacity. About 20 new deaths were also reported throughout the state last week. Dr. Spitter says a majority of the patients hospitalized right now are unvaccinated. All of this was announced yesterday as major stadiums and event centers announced they would become vaccinated-only venues. The first to announce happened right after our show ended yesterday, Climate Pledge Arena, saying all guests would have to show proof of vaccination and wear masks while inside. Graham Johnson with our news partner, Cairo 7 TV, has more details.
Doc Graham is assistant general manager at Climate Pledge Arena. He says at first, the arena will have checkpoints outside where eligible fans show their vaccination proof using an app before they reach the door. Eventually, they hope to do vaccination checks when they sell tickets.
Unfortunately, the ticketing process is just not there yet to be able to blend the two processes together.
And soon after, Climate Pledge Arena clamped down on who they'll let into the event center. The Seahawks, Mariners, Huskies, and Cougs followed suit. All of those teams will now require proof of vaccination. or you can get a COVID test up to 72 hours before the event and show them proof of a negative test. Al Griffin, he has sold sausages to Seattle sports fans for 23 years.
If you're a diehard sports fan, and that's the guideline now, that's going to motivate you to get your shot.
He says it's a good thing, and maybe the Seahawks are the example we should follow. Last year, the Seahawks were the only team in the NFL that didn't have a single positive coronavirus test on the team. And then we learn about a new COVID variant, the Mu mutation. Health officials say there have been 111 cases of the Mu variant reported in Washington, paling in comparison to the Delta variant. UW Medicine says there's still not enough data yet to determine how effective the existing vaccines are against this Mu variant. UW does know, does do the bulk of the genetic sequencing in our state. And right now they're just saying they don't know if this variant is associated with increased transmissibility, like the Delta, or immune escape, meaning it can get past your vaccine protection. The jury's still out on that one. Even so,
even if a particular variant shows some sort of diminished efficiency against the vaccines, it's still going to protect you from being very sick.
That's Pavita Roy-Choudhury. She's an expert with UW Medicine. The first Mu variant case to appear in our state happened in April.
This is Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross. Let's go to the director of the UW Virology Lab, Dr. Keith Jerome, and let's get the update on COVID. But first, tell me about the Mu variant, and where's that? How bad is it? Is it coming here?
Well, I think we don't really know what Mu's going to do right now. It is yet another variant. Seems to have certain things we would be concerned about. Seems to kind of focus on the ability to evade immunity, which is a little different from Delta, which seems to mostly work by being more infectious. So we're going to watch it. It may or may not outcompete Delta. Delta has really just beaten all the other variants. So we sort of need to spend the time and see what happens. I'll say this, that we certainly have seen it here. We have found cases in Washington. Yeah. But they're very rare right now, and we don't have any evidence that they're growing in frequency yet. But again, we'll have to wait and see.
So is everything Delta now?
Nearly. 99%+. Wow. Almost everything's Delta.
I mean, I saw stats that hospitalizations, and this is nationwide, have doubled from a year ago. Did you think we'd still be in it now?
I sure hoped not. We'd love to get this behind us, just like everybody else. But I've certainly spent a long time studying viruses, and they're tricky, and they do things we don't expect, and we've seen that here, and unfortunately, we've seen it for the worse.
I've certainly heard from listeners, in a commentary, I expressed some sympathy for people, you know, who genuinely are worried about the vaccine and didn't get it and got infected, and I said we should, you know, show some understanding. People said, no, we're done with this. The unvaccinated are dangerous. They carry a larger virus load. They could infect kids 12 and under who aren't vaccinated. Where do you come down on this? How strict should we be with people who don't get the vaccine?
Well, as physicians, we are always going to treat the sick people in front of us. I mean, that's just the reality of the oath that we took, and that's what's going to happen. I think on a societal level, once you get outside the realm of medicine, then I think as a society, we can decide how much risk we're going to let individuals take and how much risk we will let them take when those paying the risk are others in society. And that's partially what we're seeing here. So you're seeing more and more vaccine mandates. At least we won't make you take the vaccine, but if you want to work here or go to school here or participate in this or this activity, you have to have been vaccinated. And I suspect you're going to see more and more of that as this wears on and people want to get back to their lives.
It's been pointed out to me that even people who are vaccinated can get reinfected with COVID and have a what will carry a viral load and can pass on that load in a similar amount to people who are unvaccinated. Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, in a nuanced way, that's true. So certainly we know that the vaccines are better at preventing illness and hospitalization from Delta than they are preventing any infection with Delta. So we're definitely seeing more and more cases of people who have been vaccinated have a positive Delta test, okay, or positive COVID test with Delta. We're seeing more and more groups of people who are all vaccinated kind of spread it between themselves. Now, generally, these folks aren't getting sick, but I think where this is heading is we're going to find out that this concept of herd immunity, where those of us who got the vaccine are going to protect the ones who chose not to, I don't think that's going to be working much, and we're going to go back to the vaccine protects you.
Yeah,
it definitely does reduce how infectious you are. I think that's pretty clear that it seems to reduce the amount of virus that you have if you do get infected and how long you're infectious. But that's not complete. So, yeah, people can certainly pass the virus on even if they've been vaccinated.
So then how do you, if we're going to have this large cohort then of unvaccinated people where the virus is incubating and presumably morphing into the next variant, and at the same time we have no approved vaccine for children under 12, I mean, this has got to be terrifying to parents, the idea that there might be that their kid couldn't be infected by, well, I guess both vaccinated and unvaccinated people. So what do you do if you're a parent?
Well, certainly the pediatric vaccine trials are moving forward. There should be data from the Pfizer trials later this month. We were originally hoping there'd be an approval, hopefully by the time school started. Clearly that didn't happen. FDA requested more people in the trials and longer follow-up, really to be sure they're safe. Even with Delta, it's still true that kids generally do better with the infection than adults, although we're seeing more and more kids in the hospital now. We do need to be sure that it's safe. Kids are different than adults. They have different potential side effects and their immune systems are different. So we do need to figure this out and make sure that the risk benefit is correct, that the kids benefit more from the vaccine than they might from any potential problems with the vaccine. And I think that's going to be the case, but we don't want to be wrong on things like that. And FDA is very, very risk averse in terms of, they really don't want to have an approved product hurt anyone.
Of course not. Of course not. So kids would be smart to continue wearing N95 masks?
All the things we've been saying to do, the distancing, the masks, the washing hands, minimizing exposure to large groups as much as possible, although clearly kids need to be in school. These are tough decisions, Dave. We all know how much having kids out of school has hurt education and development for so many. So these are tough things, but all those actions to try to reduce the number of cases need to continue.
In the meantime, then, vaccination is still the best way to stay out of the hospital. Even if you do end up carrying some COVID virus, at least you're not going to end up on a ventilator near death.
That's exactly right. And for the folks who, if you are vaccinated and you have an exposure or a positive COVID test and find out, there's good information online at CDC and from the Washington State Department of Health about how you ought to keep yourself away from others to minimize spreading this virus. It's important to still do the right thing. Even if you are vaccinated, try not to spread that virus if you get it.
And the boosters are coming, right?
Boosters are coming. Yep. We should see those starting up hopefully in the next month or two. It'll start with the people who got Pfizer, I think, and spread to the Moderna folks later on.
All right. The head of the UW Virology Lab, Dr. Keith Jerome. Keith, thanks very much.
Take care, Dave. Bye.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. You can be kind to yourself. Sometimes it's as simple as talking to your inner child. What does your inner child want to hear? I didn't know I needed to hear this, but remember Steve from the Nick Jr. show, Blue's Clues? Maybe your kids watched Blue's Clues. He dropped a message for his early viewers, who are now elder millennials, like myself, and it's really sweet. He starts off by talking about how he left the show. He went off to college, quote unquote, and he realized that it was kind of abrupt. 20 years ago, we were all really attached to him, and then he was gone for like 20 years. So here's a portion of this out of the blue, pun intended, video message.
Because I realized that was kind of abrupt. I just kind of got up and went to college. And that was really challenging, by the way, but great, because I got to use my mind and take a step at a time, and now I literally am doing many of the things that I wanted to do. And then look at you, and look at all you have done, and all you have accomplished in all that time. And it's just so amazing, right? I mean, we started out with clues, and now it's what? Student loans, and jobs, and families, and some of it has been kind of hard. You know? I know you know. And I wanted to tell you that I really couldn't have done all of that without your help. And in fact, all the help that you helped me with when we were younger is still helping me today, right now. And that's super cool. I guess I just wanted to say that after all these years, I never forgot you. Ever. And I'm super glad we're still friends. Thanks for listening. You look great, by the way. Whatever it is you're doing, it's working.
It's just so pure, isn't it? It's the kind of positive affirmation and example of a close, courageously vulnerable relationship that Blue's Clues was and is known for, I guess. And we need more of that today. So I wanted to put it out there in the universe, hoping that you will continue those ripples of kindness today. Time to talk with G. Scott from the G. and Ursula Show. It's weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio. Good morning, G.
Good morning. Good morning. What's happening?
You drove into the studio today. What a gorgeous sunrise we had.
Whoa, it was beautiful. Well, you know what wasn't beautiful? That traffic.
Oh, yes. I heard from Sully that we're back to sort of pre-pandemic traffic levels.
Yeah. So. Oh,
sorry about that. Glad you made it in, though.
Yeah.
Really interesting decisions coming out of the NFL, or should we call them adjustments to sportsmanship and numbers? Why these little changes?
Well, the NFL, look, let me say this. There's a lot of times where I don't like some of the rules, right? Like the taunting, the taunting police are out. And so you're no longer allowed to taunt the opponent. Then there's other things like the jersey switch. And if you have a, let's say you're a higher number, you are number 87 and you want to go down to a number 3, then you have to pay for the jerseys that were in circulations. As much as sometimes I might complain about these rules, Colleen, this is why the NFL is king. This is why, yes, because they are playing to the audience. This is why people are like, oh, this is so soft in the NFL now. The defense can't even hardly hit anymore. They call a flag over anything. The points are higher. You want to know why?
What?
Because nobody wants to watch a football game that ends in the score of 3-0. Or 6-3. Now, me, I'm a football fan, but that's not who they want to cater to. They want to cater to everyone. And how do you do that? You do that by having higher scoring games. So in this case, no. Colleen, some of these rule changes I don't like, but this is the NFL saying, what can we do to continue to be the number one league in the United States? And this is what they do. They constantly are changing things up. They actually listen to the fans. So those fans out there say, oh, we don't like that taunting stuff. Oh, I can't believe that. Okay, we're going to get rid of that. Even though they allow fighting in hockey. But that's another story in itself.
Well, you know how would reducing taunting and abusive language equal higher scoring games?
I think, well, that doesn't equate to those things. I'm making a point about how they change different rules, and that's another example of how they've changed, like with the no hitting and calling all the flags on the defense. That has resulted in high scoring. I'm talking about the rule change for the taunting. Let's just stay on that topic right there.
Yeah.
I don't like it. I think it's dumb. Like, come on, it's football.
Most of it we can't hear, though. Most of it they're saying to each other as they're like waiting for, what is it called? Waiting for the tip, or what do they do when they throw the ball to the... What is it called? When they're lined up and they're ready for the quarterback to make a move, they're all talking to each other and being mean. What's that called?
Oh, you're talking about waiting for the quarterback to hike the ball.
Snap.
Waiting for snap, yeah.
That word escaped me for so long, I got scared for my brain for a second.
That's all right. But it happens.
You don't hear that stuff.
No, you don't hear it, but you see it on television, right? You might see that wide receiver or that running back getting ready to score a touchdown, and then they wave at the opponent, bye-bye, that kind of deal. They don't want that on TV.
I see. Yeah, like popping a squat on the football, that was a little lewd, right? But there's some fun touchdown celebration dances. Can they do dances still?
Yeah, they can still do dances. They just can't taunt.
They just can't look at the opponent while they do it. Yeah.
Again, let me just say this. I think that these rule changes are, you know, not cool. You know what it reminds me of?
What?
It reminds me of HOA. Like, I can't stand HOA. If somebody listening right now, you know what I'm talking about.
I go walk back and forth on HOAs.
Those passive-aggressive letters you get in your good to see you yesterday, Lois, but just want to let you know you're not allowed to have that flag right there. You know, that's how the letter reads. I'm reading it in that voice.
Those are the dumb ones. But, like, HOAs also prevent your neighborhood block from looking like a junkyard. You know what I mean? Or they prevent your neighbor from painting their house Seahawks colors and keep it neutral, right? Like, there's some good HOAs.
That's why I gave this NFL thing. It's the same thing. Like, I get upset with little nagging letters, but at the same time, the HOA keeps your neighborhood from looking like the one neighborhood where the guy has 10 used cars in front of his house, right? Yeah. Or the other neighbor has a house that they painted pink on one side and green on the other.
Yeah, Pepto-Bismol pink. It's just... bless their hearts. Maybe just color makes them happy and I should lay off, but it is so jarring to have a home that's pink.
It really is. So that's what the NFL does, right? The NFL is trying to, like, look, we're going to make these rules, and yes, G and Colleen, you're going to make fun of them, but you know what you are going to do? You're going to be watching these games. You're going to be continuing. You're going to have those get-togethers and those parties, and that's what the NFL has done a great job of. Not just football fans, but even the pedestrian fan who maybe they don't really know everything about football, but they enjoy being around that atmosphere.
Let me say it. It's me. They're catering to me. They're catering to the Karens.
Now, I just want to go on record and say I did not say that. But anyway.
I know. But, I'm not a Karen. I can have Karen flare-ups, but I'm not a Karen.
You ever been to somebody's house for a hockey get-together?
No, I prefer to go to the game.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Nobody. Yeah. How about a baseball get together? Hey, we're having some people over. We're going to watch the baseball game. You ever had that?
No. I see what you're saying. All right, G. Thank you for clarifying for me all of that. Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. We have Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner with us this morning. Always delightful to talk about home prices. It's a tough topic to talk about because there's a lot of frustration out there, Matthew.
It is still tough. I mean, I think there's a couple of things within the numbers in August which are worthwhile chatting about very briefly. Obviously, listing activity is down, but you know what? It's August. That really isn't a surprise. Traditionally, we do see a pullback then. So it's tight in terms of homes on the market and the number of them. However, pending sales rose in the central Puget Sound, which is certainly a sign that there is still significant interest from buyers out there, irrespective of the fact that there is next to nothing to choose from.
Right. Although I am seeing in some pockets of communities, at least in mine here in Edmonds, a lot more for sale signs up. Are they going for list price or are we still in bidding war season?
Well, that's a good question. We are still, although it's not quite as frenetic as it was. We are in bidding war season. And the reason why I can say that is that I tend to like to look at list prices. They're kind of more of a leading indicator. And what I found fascinating was that the median list price, let's say in King County, was higher, was lower than the median sale price. So when you've got sale price above list prices, it means that obviously homes are going for above the price that's being asked. So that is applicable in King and Snohomish counties, not so much yet down in Pierce. But the market is still very, very robust. But as you mentioned, we are seeing some pockets of additional inventory, and I'm hopeful that we will see that level of number start to increase as we get into the fall naturally are all dependent upon COVID.
Sometimes when I read all of the information out there, like I just read a couple of articles out of the Seattle Times about 13% of all Seattle homeowners have been in that home for 30 years. And then construction, if it's up or down, and home prices and list. And I fail to realize what exactly applies to the average homeowner. All of this data is really interesting, but it's all very meaty and it's hard to cut through. And that's where you come in. What are we paying attention to if we want to be a homeowner?
Well, okay, let's go through that list. Yes, we are living in our homes in the Seattle area in general for twice as long as we did back no more than a decade or so ago. So we're not moving for our jobs as frequently, or if we are taking a new job, we're staying put. We're not seeing people downsize. We're not retiring when we're supposed to. We're staying in the workforce longer. So because of that, we're not going to move. And if we're not seeing that downsizing, it means that people looking to move up, those second-time home buyers, they're limited in terms of the choice of homes out there. And if they can't find somewhere, they're not going to sell. If they can't sell, well, that means the first-time buyers are shot. So, yes, we are living in our homes for a lot longer than we used to. On the construction standpoint, although everyone's been talking about lumber prices, which went parabolic several months ago, they have pulled back dramatically. However, it's not just lumber. It's all the components to build a house and also, believe it or not, appliances as well. There's a shortage out there. So new home builders are having a hard time, again, because of cost. So if we're creating households, we're not building enough housing, what does that do? That puts upward price pressure on the existing housing stock. And that's exactly where we are today.
Where is the help coming from? This cannot continue for much longer.
No, it can't. And in fact, we are. I think we're starting to see that apex. We're reaching that peak right now. And again, as I mentioned earlier on, I do like to look at list prices as opposed to sale prices. And we're seeing some softening in the pace of increase in those numbers. So obviously, for several years now, home sellers have had it pretty much all their way. They've pushed prices and pushed prices. But we are reaching that affordability ceiling. In fact, here in King County, we've not just reached it, we've blown through it. And because of that, I do expect that the pace of appreciation is going to start to slow, not just because of affordability, but we are going to start to see mortgage rates start to notch up, not by much, but they are going to start increasing as well. Combine those things, we will see a slowdown, but I'm afraid just not quite yet.
Overall, the Seattle economy, how is it looking? You know, we're hearing still, we just had Beth's Cafe, a storied cafe in Seattle, shut down because of the pandemic. Help wanted signs are everywhere. It just seems everybody's under stress because of the pandemic, the job shortage, the unemployment. What's the outlook on the Seattle economy? Or let's not focus on Seattle. Let's talk about the region.
Well, I mean, the unemployment rate in the metro area down just a notch above 5% in June. We haven't got the July numbers out yet. So still, that's actually pretty impressive given where we were a year or so ago. So we're in an interesting situation. We are seeing a lot of people. It's really kind of bifurcated. And I think I've talked about this before. We've got a lot of job openings out there. They tend to be in fairly select different industries. Primarily leisure and hospitality, those bars, those restaurants, and naturally hotels. And I will tell you one thing, Colleen, there's a sign in my neighborhood with a signing bonus of $1,000 in a restaurant for a cook. That says kind of a lot. There are job shortages certainly in those more face-to-face industries, far less so in the professional technical services. And these are people who, quite frankly, kept on working through the pandemic. Yes, they were working from home, but they were still working. So it does tend to focus more on the blue collar sector of the economy rather than the white collar.
Is there any precedent out there to show us how long we can be in this near frozen state of activity? People hesitant to go to restaurants or maybe cutting back on their grocery store trips. Anything out there that shows us, I think we can survive this maybe another year, but we've got to get people back out there?
As we know, all know, the last time we saw this, well, we didn't, it was 1815 with the Spanish flu pandemic. So, 1915. So it's been a long, long time. And so there really is no precedent. We're in a very different place then than we are today. However, if we look at the overall numbers, yes, a lot of us are still working. A majority of us are still working. And that does very much apply, as I mentioned earlier, to those industries where you can work from home. But in a lot of respects, I think a lot of the larger companies in our area who are planning on people coming back to work after Labor Day. Well, given the increase in new people catching COVID, they're now pushing that back. A lot of companies now until the start of January. So it just adds an increased amount of uncertainty. And what markets do not like is uncertainty. Can we get through it? Of course we will. Are a majority of us still working? Yes, we are. But I think we're just, quite frankly, just sick and tired, no pun intended, of what we've been going through. We want to come out of the end of it. We will, but unfortunately, just not quite yet. Has it got the capacity to drag us back into another recession? I just don't see that happening. But there are certain significant obstacles, without a doubt, that are out there still that we were hoping would be gone by now.
All right, Chief Economist for Windermere, Matthew Gardner, always a joy talking to you. Thanks so much.
Delightful talking to you, Colleen. You take care.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.